And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Turn on the news these days, and global warming is drowning out a lot of the other stories. And it's about time. So we can take a break and focus on what's happening right now in our own backyards, backwoods, and back rooms. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's nothing like the first week of daylight savings time to assure the body and spirit that spring is in the air. And with spring come many changes. The week's weather portends what may be another year of big weather stories as massive storms this week swept across the mid-country. And speaking of changes in the air, in our first segment, we're off to the nation's capital to learn about some changes in the air quality regulations at the EPA. There's quite a stink being raised about how these changes are sneaking into the regulations originally designed to protect us. Well, that just may not be what the EPA's all about these days. And while we're talking about the dangers hiding in the unseen, in our second segment, we help you avoid the dangers of the real snakes in the grass. Yes, with spring comes the return of the dangers from potential snake bites. We talk with a leading expert who has to deal with 50 and more venomous snake bite victims a year about how to minimize your chances of snake bites and what you need to know should you come face to face with a rattling snake. We then balance off the news with some interesting new plans coming out of the BLM. Following a difficult week or two at the nation's number one public lands agency, we hear about the softer side of government in a unique story that brings us back to the core values of we the people and our great lands. So we've got a lot of ground to cover, and we'd best get started. So first, the news. A brutal spring storm front that swept across the central states, killing 27 and destroying hundreds of homes, begins yet another year in which big weather is predicted to hold a grip on the headlines. The Federal Storm Prediction Center reported 63 tornadoes stretching across Tennessee, Missouri, Arkansas, Iowa, and Illinois. Meanwhile, forecasters with the National Hurricane Center are predicting yet another difficult hurricane season scheduled to officially begin on June 1st. Few people dispute the effect that global warming may be playing in the increasingly severe weather that is creating chaos around the globe. The bird flu continues its flight around the world, first appearing in 2003 in Asia. Cases are now confirmed in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. The United States is expected to see its first case of bird flu before the end of this year. The virus has killed 107 people since 2003, but fears exist that a more virulent strain may evolve, which would spread amongst humans and could bring on a worldwide pandemic. Symptoms of bird flu in humans have ranged from typical influenza-like symptoms such as fever, cough, sore throat, and muscle aches, to eye infections, pneumonia, and acute respiratory distress, viral pneumonia, and severe life-threatening complications. On a positive front, environmentalists declared victory on Monday as key Japanese firms quit the whaling business after a pressure campaign. The government of Japan, however, vowed not to change its controversial annual hunt. Fishing giant Nisui and four other firms have promised to turn over their equipment and shareholdings to public interest corporations. This decision completely demolishes the commercial foundation of the Japanese whaling industry, Greenpeace campaigns manager Danny Kennedy said in a statement. It is clear that even in Japan, the message is getting through that whaling is bad for business. Nisui, Japan's largest seafood company, said it would stop distributing and selling whale meat. While Wyoming is fast developing natural gas and oil sites, Governor Dave Freudenthal is drawing a line against leases for drilling sites on 19,000 acres within the Bridger-Teton National Forest. Freudenthal has informed federal officials he opposes plans to lease parcels within the area for drilling while a previous lease sale is appealed. Freudenthal, in a letter, asked the U.S. government to suspend lease sales scheduled for next month until the appeal is resolved. Quoting the governor, "To do otherwise will be perceived by many as a predetermination of the existing appeals." He went on to say, "In the spirit of administrative and judicial economy, and with the knowledge that there are likely to be a significant number of procedurally similar appeals that come as a result of all future leasing in the Bridger-Teton, it seems logical to resolve the December sale appeals before offering additional parcels for lease." About 44,000 acres have been slated for oil and gas leasing in the Bridger-Teton, prompting opposition by a number of groups that want the area off limits to drilling, which is booming in Wyoming. Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated Chief Executive Henry Paulson Friday defended the firm's environmental policy and his roles as chairman of the Nature Conservancy, saying they don't interfere with the global investment bank's performance. Last year, Goldman established an environmental policy vowing to take steps to protect forests and curb development that boosts emissions of greenhouse gases. Their firm pledged to invest $1 billion in renewable energy, form an environmental think tank, and post research on environmental issues. The green is going green. And that's the news. The news from the nation's capital keeps us all wondering what's next. And in that atmosphere, we head to Washington, D.C. The sky is falling. The sky is falling. Falling to the secret powers of the inside deals. This show is a show of good news, and we kind of counter that occasionally with stories that challenge us sometimes. And one that I find particularly personally disturbing, and I'm laughing because it just seems as if this just keeps on going on and on and on, is a story about something that's happening at the EPA, where sort of once again there are these behind-the-scenes machinations and changes in policy that are done, oftentimes in ways that tend to violate trusted traditions of process, to put it lightly. This particular issue deals with a secret EPA rule that would allow more carcinogens in the air, and the person who is very responsible for bringing this story forward is John Walk. He's the Clean Air Director with the NRDC. He's also a senior attorney with the organization. John, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you for having me.
Give us an overview of what's at the crux of this story. What is this? What's the story about this secret draft?
The Clean Air Act, since 1990, has regulated toxic air pollution very effectively in this country. The statute regulates about 188 different types of toxic pollution, many of which are carcinogens. And it does so from about 200 industrial source categories for refineries and chemical plants and factories and other types of industrial plants around the country. Since 1990, we've cut about 1.7 million tons of toxic air pollution on an annual basis as a result of this very effective law. What I learned through a rule that was leaked from sources at the Environmental Protection Agency is that the Bush administration has prepared a proposed rulemaking to change those very effective laws in order to allow industrial facilities to backslide, to actually increase the amount of toxic air pollution that they put into our air, our water, and that deposits onto the food we eat through crops, and that the agency had circulated this proposal for internal review, and regional officials in EPA's offices around the country, 7 of their 10 regional offices, had objected very strongly, very passionately, opposing this rule change, noting that it would be detrimental to the environment, that it would increase airborne toxic pollution in the communities around those plants, and that on top of that, the regions had been cut out of the process of preparing this proposal, and they decried the trend of EPA headquarters excluding them from rule and policy development such as this one.
And that really is quite amazing in the sense that the standard procedure is for these regional offices to really, it's supposed to be kind of a collective effort at crafting our future regulations and standards. So to repeat what you're saying, but I'd like you to go on a little bit about this, they were really cut out of that process.
That's correct. I should note that I was an attorney in headquarters at the Environmental Protection Agency for about 4 years until 2000. And the standard process when I was in the agency was to have work groups with representatives from headquarters and each of the regions, and they would collaborate on the development of rules and policies. And then that collaborative effort would be circulated to higher-ups in the agency, and there would be consensus among the Clean Air Office and the Enforcement Office and the regional offices before something was even put out for public comment for people like you and me to comment on before the rules were changed. This memo makes very clear that that process not only broke down in this instance, but if you read what these officials are saying, that breakdown has become a disturbing trend, their words, at the Environmental Protection Agency, where they are being cut out of the process. And I can offer some insights into why that would be so. Historically, and it remains true under this administration, the regional officials around the country who are closer to the public, the communities where factories pollute, and the states where public health is protected, those officials tend to be more protective of public health and more committed to the environmental and public health mission of the Environmental Protection Agency. By contrast, the officials in headquarters are more often appointed through the political process by the president. And in headquarters of the EPA today, there is a substantial number of former industry lobbyists and officials who are in charge of the programs in headquarters. And in this particular instance, the head of EPA's Clean Air Program is a former industry official who is dictating this policy and receives strong objections from the civil servants around EPA when they learned of this.
What I find disturbing about that is the fact that, you know, the EPA certainly has done some terrific things and it oftentimes is criticized for its failures. The strategy for making decisions which reflected this almost a much more democratic kind of national perspective with experts. Most people working in the EPA are dedicated to really doing exactly what they're supposed to do, and that is to really protect the public from various dangers. In this particular case, it has to do with air. Their expertise is invaluable in really trying to bring about these policies that protect all of us, and it's a wise form of democratic process, and we're best served when that can be maintained. And unfortunately, as they say, there is a trend. It's obvious to anyone who's paying attention to these things that there's a willful attempt to really subvert that process, and that's what we're talking about here. And these people whose job it is to protect us are beginning to be offended, and it's kind of the point where in many cases when you speak out, you get in trouble, but they're preparing to do that because they feel, quite honestly, that it has potentially grievous effects on our ability to regulate and protect our air. They are actually saying that the changes, based on their judgment, could have negative effects.
They say very clearly that they believe the changes will lead to actual increases in toxic and cancer-causing pollution. And they are both mystified and, I say, based upon the language they use, outraged over this step. The headquarters office that prepared this rule under the direction of this former industry lobbyist, interestingly, does not deny that toxic pollution could increase. the draft rule that I obtained says that, in fact, that could happen, that you could have, in some instances, pollution going up. The draft rule goes on to say, however, something quite extraordinary that the regions, I think, object to very strongly. The draft rule says it's more likely that pollution will not go up and that facilities will continue to keep polluting at the same levels. And here I'm going to quote from the rule now. In order to, quote, avoid negative publicity and to maintain their appearance as responsible businesses. So what the draft rule is saying is, yes, it is true that we are weakening the rules on their face, weakening the legal requirements, and eliminating legal requirements that apply today. But it is our prediction that industrial facilities will not increase pollution given the legal right and the opportunity to increase pollution. And the reasons that they put forward are that businesses will want to avoid negative publicity and to maintain their business reputations. Needless to say, that rationale is controversial, and the regions dismiss it out of hand, and the regional officials claim that it is both unfounded and overly optimistic and directly at odds with the on-the-ground experience of regions who, when witnessing industrial behavior, see that if laws are relaxed, then polluters will increase pollution. If the speed limit is raised, people will drive faster. And that is what they point out in their forceful memo.
As I read this, it's almost humorous. And I actually try to be very objective, but my objectivity forces me to say this. I'm reiterating what you're saying, but it's just so amazing that the internal government's case is that businesses, to avoid negative publicity, will opt for the highest levels of protection because they don't want to appear bad. But what I find ironic about that is that that's the mandate out to the world out there, but within the agency itself, the EPA, they're suddenly making themselves subject to extraordinary negative publicity, and also that they're willing to abort the appearance of a responsible agency, although they're supposed to protect that. It's odd.
There are two further ironies that I will point out, since you, I think, honed in on something very interesting. The first irony, which I haven't mentioned yet, is that in addition to allowing industrial facilities to pollute more, as I described, this rule change would also eliminate monitoring and reporting and record-keeping requirements that they're currently subject to. So the additional irony is that the public and the press will be denied information about their toxic levels that's currently required, leading one to ask, how is negative publicity ever going to happen if the press and the public are now being denied the very information that would tell us whether pollution is going up? And the rule never even grapples with that question. It's just a kind of an implicit irony that left me scratching my head.
It reminds me of the hanging chad issue, when people were holding the punch cards up to their head and trying to divine the will and intent, or in this case, the malintent. So anyways, moving on, let's without getting too technical, help the listeners understand the changes. Help us understand these changes.
I noted that the Clean Air Act, since 1990, has been very effective in cleaning up pollution, and toxic pollution in particular. And the reason it's done so is that Congress established a new type of regulating pollution. They instructed EPA to develop rules based upon the greatest reductions in pollution that could be achieved through good technology. They're called technology standards. EPA is supposed to identify the best technologies available in the market and to apply them to different types of industries to get the greatest reduction feasible in toxic air pollution. And the reason Congress took that step is because they cared so very much about toxic pollution that caused cancer and birth defects and the like. So EPA, with that instruction, has issued rules that require very impressive 99%, 95% control requirements to require pollution to be reduced by 95% from what it was before. That has caused pollution in many instances to fall down to levels approaching 1 or 2 or 5 tons of toxic pollution, which, mind you, is still an extraordinary amount since we measure the toxicity of many types of toxic pollution in the ounces. It's so deadly that an ounce is very harmful to the human body. But nonetheless, we've gotten them down to those levels. What this rule would do is to identify a cutoff point and say, if your pollution is below 25 tons annually from a single plant, we are going to allow you to become deregulated. So for that plant that, because it has complied with a very effective law and reduced its pollution down to 1 or 2 or 5 or 10 tons, it suddenly finds itself in a deregulatory windfall where the Bush administration has declared that because it's done such a good job, they're going to be deregulated. And here's the kicker. Once you're deregulated, your pollution can go all the way back up to 25 tons because you're only regulated if you have more than 25 tons. So it's a classic backsliding invitation where plants that have complied with the law to protect us all by reducing down to the lowest levels will be the very ones given the greatest leeway to increase their pollution back up to 25 tons from each plant in America.
And I believe it used to be that any plant that was producing more than 10 tons was required to use these best practices, and they had to install them. Now they've kind of upped that to 25. And, of course, the case is made that, of course, they won't violate these things. They won't allow their pollution to go up because they don't want the bad publicity.
That's correct.
Yeah. What has happened since then? It's getting interesting.
Well, there's been an enormous outcry as a result of this information that's now publicly available. And by the way, I should mention for your listeners that it's available on my organization's website, which is nrdc.org. I've placed the documents and the press release up on our website so that you can examine them yourselves. I wanted the public to have a chance to evaluate for themselves the value of what the Bush administration was planning to do and reach their own opinion.
And also there is a copy of the memo coming back from the regional directors, which I think it's a must read.
It is, and that's much more interesting, and it's written in language that I think people can understand better than the rule itself, which is admittedly technical and complicated. But the region's memo really lasers in on the concerns with why they think this is both unlawful and harmful to air quality and to public health. So there's been an outcry. This story has appeared in newspapers around the country and on some radio shows. And just today in the United States Senate, there was a hearing before the Environment Committee to entertain the president's nomination of this former industry lobbyist I mentioned earlier, who is acting as the head of EPA's air program right now. The president formally nominated this gentleman, a gentleman named Bill Wareham, to be the official head of EPA's air program. And members of the U.S. Senate welcomed him before their committee today and took his testimony. And this change in policy was the subject of actually considerable interest and attention. What was most notable is that Mr. Wareham declined to apologize for this rule change. He did not disavow it. He did not agree with the criticisms of the region. And he even didn't address the question of one senator asking how it was that these officials could have been cut out of the process. I was in the room, and I think it's generous to characterize his remarks as filibustering of sorts. What he said in response to the point that they described their exclusion as a disturbing trend, he said, in effect, well, one of the great things about EPA is that we have really robust internal conversations.
Well, this is nothing new, unfortunately, and I'm trying to be objective and fair, but it's getting a little tiresome, quite honestly, the way in which this process, the change through secret executive fiat, changes, significant changes that affect us all. It's a strategy that is apparently willfully designed to do end runs around otherwise existing legislation and laws. It's quite honestly disturbing. And then I guess, again, to reiterate what you just said, the fact that the officials whose job it is to work with their people in the field, there's a distancing that's happening. And it doesn't bode well for the people who are out there in the field. I think they're getting upset.
Well, and it's not what the American people should expect of the Environmental Protection Agency. They trust our government officials and that agency in particular to safeguard public health and the environment and to clean up and address some very real public health troubles that we still have in this country. We've made a tremendous amount of progress in this country due to the good work of the EPA. And let me echo your sentiment earlier that there are some fine public servants who work there. But it doesn't take many individuals in headquarters or much of a thing, really, to completely take over the agenda of the agency and to redirect it into a direction that industry prefers. All it takes is really one person at EPA with support from the White House through the agency that works with EPA in the White House to decide to change course so radically. And that's what happened here. That's how this ball got rolling. And it really wasn't until the end of the line that the regions learned of this and objected so strongly. And now, fortunately, we're having a robust social discussion and debate about whether this is what the EPA should be about and whether they should be allowing more cancer-causing pollution into the air by backsliding from stronger protections that we already have on the books.
You know, I meant to watch that hearing. Was there a confirmation vote taken?
No. The Senate will go into Easter recess shortly. I believe they will return to their districts for a period of about 2 weeks. And then the vote on the nomination in that committee will probably occur in about 2 weeks' time.
Do you think enough issues are raised to make this a difficult confirmation?
I think this will be a difficult confirmation, and both a Republican and Democratic senator acknowledged as much at the hearing today.
Well, a lot is being found out right now about the process and the outrage is spreading, as it should.
Well, I believe that there should be a public airing of the policies that this nominee created over the past 5 years at EPA. He happens to have been an architect of reversible air pollution measures of the Bush administration, so that record was the subject of much discussion today.
Well, bottom line is, so now what? Is there anything that the American public can actually do in these regards? I mean, how can we change this strategy that is being foisted upon us? I mean, we're ultimately becoming victimized by this.
We are, but there are plenty of good people still in Congress and at the Environmental Protection Agency who need to know that the public doesn't support or appreciate things like this. And it's almost silly hearing myself saying that because, of course, who supports more cancer in the air, carcinogens in the air? But the truth is that they will proceed with this proposal. Mr. Wareham made that clear at his confirmation hearing that they plan to go full steam ahead. And frankly, the only thing that would stop them is sufficient public outrage with the public contacting their members of Congress and flooding the head of the EPA, Stephen Johnson, with emails to make clear that this is not the direction they want this country going in. Barring that type of public outrage, I believe that EPA will go right ahead with this proposal.
Well, John, once again, give your website address so the people who want to find out more about this can easily find it.
The website for the Natural Resources Defense Council is nrdc.org, and there is a link on our homepage with a press release talking about an EPA proposal that would allow more carcinogens in the air. You can click on that link and take you to where you can obtain this EPA regional memo, as well as the draft rule and my analysis and description of the controversy.
John Walk with the Natural Resources Defense Council, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney. I really appreciate it.
We need to clean the air, and the best way to do so is with the light of knowledge, which we bring you each week here on the Wildside News. And in that spirit, we're heading west to California, where we're taking a walk on the wild side, where you need to watch your step when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wildside News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. And record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.